Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Every day you trust your gut, and that gut feeling can lead to a kick in the guts, but your gut instinct was right, so you bust a gut because someone will have your guts if you don't. You know what your gut deserves? Glenillan Farm Yogurt. Breasting with live cultures, it's the daily way to keep your gut happy and healthy, and tastes delicious to boot. Choose Irish, choose local, choose Glenillan Farm.
Welcome to the Dope Black Dads podcast, a place where we are changing the narrative and having progressive conversations about black fathers, as well as creating a safe digital space for the community. This is the Dope Black Dad podcast. My name is Marvin Harrison. Today, I'm actually very excited because this is a year-long conversation in the making, and I'm joined by Ralph Little. How are you, Ralph?
Hello, I'm good, thanks.
So obviously, you've been on screens for basically over 20 years.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
It's very fair to say. I mean, I wish you wouldn't say it quite so starkly. I feel very old now, but yes, I guess so. Yes. You could have said something like, you've graced our screens for quite a while now, but instead you're like, dude, you're old.
This is my BTEC presenting, okay? This is what you get when you come off of the mainstream. So, Death in Paradise, Royal Family, Two yep. Pints of Lager, you've been on our screens for a fantastic and memorable 20 years. A fully mature, grown-up man. We're both men. We're about the same age, I feel like. I'm feeling like I'm making this up. I don't want to do the age thing on you, but I feel like we must be roughly the same age.
Yeah, I'm 41 this year.
Just a little bit older. It's fine. Anyway, so glad to have you.
Had to slip that in. You're like, oh yeah, I think I'm around like 31. Is it? Yeah, sure. You knew. This whole thing is a massive stitch-up.
I felt like when you were on the Royal Family, we were the same age. We were both the same child in our families. We were slightly geniuses and no one understood us. And so we had to dumb ourselves down.
Exactly. Be the family, you know, brewmate. All the time.
So I thank you so much for reaching out originally. So for those who don't know, you reached out about a year ago, right in the middle of just after George Floyd, when there was so many protests going on. It was a very, very active time. And you were just like, if there's anything I can do to help, I love what you guys are doing. And at the time, I think it was just so manic. It was very difficult to even know what to do with that response. So I said, at some point, we will definitely have a conversation. And then obviously I took some time off the podcast and now I'm back. And I feel like actually now it's almost a year on, it feels like a really good time to have that conversation about where you were a year ago and what did you observe, which made you reach out. Because ultimately, I think, in essence, you were holding your hand out as almost like an ally saying, you know, how can I support? What can I use my platform to do? What can I use myself to do? And not many people felt comfortable doing so. Can you tell me what was happening for you at that time? What did you observe and what made you actually put your hand up?
Well, it's... You know, if you've got any kind of humanity at all, then the George Floyd protests were shocking to the world. But they were shocking. What was possibly a more watershed moment is they were shocking to the white world because the black world, you know, has lived in this structure of power difference of a power, lower power status in society for years. And so it shook the white world into going, this isn't right. It shook the majority of, because I believe that most people are decent, but it's very difficult to have your eyes opened to a power structure that benefits you, you know? And I think that I was trying, like a lot of sort of decent, well-meaning white liberals, I was like, what can I do? What can I do about this? How is there something I can, you know, rather than just say, oh, this is terrible and put out a tweet. I was trying to listen and go, well, what, I think I read an article, that's what it was, Marvin. I read an article and it said, you know, read up on this, understand the struggle. And if you have black friends, reach out. Now is a good time to reach out and say, listen, if there's anything I can do. So I did that to my black friends. And as one of the things I was doing, I happened to be watching, I think there was an online, like a forum, an online sort of protest because for people that couldn't go out because of COVID. And I saw you talking, said Marvin's founded Dope Black Dads. And I went, this guy seems really clued in and we could have a conversation. So that's why I texted you and I Instagram messaged you and I was like, listen, if there's anything that we can talk about, should we? And I'll be honest, it's a little bit daunting, this kind of thing. Because, and please don't for a second let me go, hey, you don't know how difficult it is for us white people. You know what I mean? You think you've got it hard. I've got to come on here and talk about a podcast. And it's a bit daunting because sticking your head above the parapet, you know, it seems like such an obvious thing to do, because why wouldn't you sort of stick your head above the parapet to go, this is terribly wrong and so we should talk about it. But it is weirdly not as simple as it should be. Because I did at the time read counter arguments going, you know what, your time now as a white liberal, your time now is just to shut up and let other people speak. And I was like, okay. And then I've since read articles going, it's not enough just to buy black literature. And I'm like, okay. And the one I hear a lot is, it's not black people's problem to educate you about racism, which I absolutely get, because it must be exhausting. It must be exhausting having to, you know, been Toni Morrison talking about nothing else for so many. Imagine what she could have done. So I get all that, but that what I think that means is that people are hesitant when they shouldn't be to go, let's have a conversation. Let's at least just have any conversation and start it, which is why I reached out to you a year later to go, I meant what I said a year ago. I'd love to chat to you if you're still interested, if that makes
any sense. Absolutely. I think what's really nice about that is the follow up. To be honest, like I think in there's a lot of short termism in these types of things, or just also just fear, and just that you don't want to put your hands up twice. And you know, I hadn't actually forgotten. It was just we were just getting back into our steam in terms of having these conversations. But what was really nice is that you put your hand up again just to reiterate what it is. When did you first, you know, become aware of even racism as a concept? Because let's go back a bit, like in terms of where you were raised, I assume it's Northwest England, I'm assuming, but I could be wrong. And so can you tell me a little bit more about the context in which you were raised in?
So I grew up in Bolton, which is, I grew up in Bury, went to school in Bolton. And in Bolton, there's a very, very large Indian Pakistani community, not really a large black community. And so in school, every class I was in was like probably a third Indian Pakistani. And to be honest, I went to a nice school and it was, I didn't really see, I'll tell you what we weren't taught about in school. We weren't taught about British colonialism and occupation. So it's really interesting to think that I was in school with a load of lads for whom ancestrally they had their great grandparents even had lived under the British Raj, and it was just never talked about, which is something that we should probably talk about, needs to change. But here's the joyous naivety of growing up as a white guy in a nice school. It's like, I remember learning about the Notting Hill riots and, you know, the waves of immigration and what we now know to be called Windrush, which I don't think I remembered from school. I'm thinking, how awful. I'm so glad racism doesn't exist anymore, which is, you know,
it's over.
Yeah, we did it. My generation, yay. I think there's two ways of looking at that. One, you know, it's quite sweet, you know, that there was no sense of racism in my class, and my friends were called, you know, Todd, Simon, James, Pervez, Ramzan, Prabhu, right? That's lovely. But equally, again, I don't understand how so many people misunderstand the term white privilege. That's one of the privileges of having to grow up going, hey, racism's not around anymore, is it? That's nice. So, well, of course, that's not part of your lived experience. So why would you think that? So, I sort of wasn't aware of it. And then I moved to London. And this is another thing as well. When I went out in my early 20s and I was kind of clubbing a lot, I was all about R&B and hip hop. I know I don't look like an R&B hip hop kind of guy, but that's what I was all about. And probably the vast majority of my friends, about 7 or 8 friends, were black guys. And I think that it's a really weird thing when you go, some of my best friends are black, you know, that whole stereotype. But in a way, sometimes that that does mean something as well. Like we universally like joke that that's what racists say, but also if you know, 7 of 10 of your best friends are black guys, then you are kind of you're socializing and having their company. I don't know. Maybe it counts for something. I don't know. Anyway, so I think it does count for something.
I think it's not a retort for when you make a racial faux pas. So it's not an excuse. Exactly. And I think ultimately what we're asking, because this is also, you know, the skills we're talking about here are more than racism. This is just you as a human being, anybody. Yeah. So let's just say you offended somebody or you said something. You wouldn't use the one thread that connects you. Like if you made a cancer joke and someone said, my mom died of cancer, you wouldn't be like, oh, well, I thought I had cancer once. So it's okay to make that joke. It's a very good example.
Yeah.
What we're asking for in that moment is just accountability that, oh, I'm sorry. And just own it on the fact that you didn't mean it rather than the contextualize it as, I have 7 friends who are black and I love Jay-Z's last album. Cause then that's like saying, by loving black culture, you also love black people,
exactly,
which I think is another thing that is really, really common. I think, you know, black culture is been exported around the world, you know, Jamaican culture, if you're talking about South African culture, Nigerian and Ghanaian culture, all those cultures are very popular and the people have spread in different around the world. So often there's parts of the culture people really, really love. When you want to deal with the actual humanity of them, and we hear about what's happening in the actual local countries themselves or the people who show up in your lives, it's kind of less so. You don't want to deal with some of the things that you may not understand, but you like, you know, Afrobeats. And so Wizkid is great, but I don't want you to actually like, you know, bring your food here or something. And I think that's what we're trying to break the barriers of. You can't just like one bit because they're all interconnected. So in terms of like growing up in Bolton, you said it's particularly majority sort of South Asian population. Yeah. Was there a lot of South Asian racism? Was it like a divide? Was it inclusive? Was it, how did you find it?
This is what I mean. It felt inclusive. And I think that by the standards of probably other schools, because like I say, it was a good school, it probably was quite inclusive. But I left school under the assumption that none of those lads had undergone any race, certainly not in school, had been, you know, received any kind of racist abuse or pressure or anything. And it's only looking back now that I realize how astonishingly naive that is. Now, maybe they didn't, but the fact to assume that they didn't is astonishingly naive because, you know, and a little bit self-congratulatory. I guess some did, some didn't. It was quite an inclusive school. It was quite a nice place. But the point is, I just wouldn't have known. I wouldn't have known because of being in the position to not have to worry about it, to not have to care about it. And then you start to, again, like last year, it started to make me think of things like, okay, well, what about the times where somebody's had to, is the phrase code switch? Somebody's had to like appear to just sort of like be less of whatever they might be in one situation, in another situation. I don't know how many of those guys felt that they were having to play white. I don't know. I should probably ask him actually, but it didn't occur to me really. It didn't really even occur to me up until, I mean, maybe it did in a sort of secondary sense, but not, it didn't sort of crystallize this idea that that's what people have to live through until sort of around this time last year.
Have you ever found yourself having to assimilate like that in any scenario, whether it's gender, race, religion? Have you ever had to find yourself adjusting what you believe your values are to fit into an environment?
Yes, when I first started playing, and thank you for letting me get this in. When I first started playing semi-professional football, I feel like we teed that up nicely.
when I was on the verge of playing in a Premier League.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, I think, it was a very kind of prison rules, kill or be killed banter attitude in the changing rooms, right? And you turned up and I turned up and I was already sort of well known for being on the TV at this point. So there was this extra like, right, who's this lad coming in, you know? Mm. And so it I guess what you'd call it now is sort of toxic masculinity. Now, to be honest, a lot of it was quite funny, but that's okay for me because I was able to go, okay, well, I'm, you know, I guess I'm a performer. I'll switch into whatever mode this is and join it. But if you don't have those skills, it must have been an extremely intimidating environment. And some people say that, you know, if you can't, you know, I've heard it said by older generations, oh yeah, football's all about what you do on the pitch, but also you've got to be able to take the pressure, take the banter and whatever. And it's like, well, look, I'm not really, that's a different point, but I guess, yeah, I definitely remember thinking I'm going to have to switch up the way I behave and give up the way I give up the way I talk, to talk more like this in order to fit in. Definitely, definitely.
And what would you say the impact of that adjustment was for you?
It was difficult. It was difficult at first because when I would turn up to play football, it was more about the, actually, in a very, very specific sense, it was difficult to play good football because you worried that even in training, right? You're trying to make sure you're on the first team or whatever. And every time you're worried about getting something wrong, you're worried that you're just going to be absolutely slaughtered, you know? And it takes a while to learn to laugh that off. But in terms of the way it does have to, you go, right, I have to put on this kind of, this costume, this shell of this armor of being a different person to be able to get through this. Now, I'm talking about obviously an extremely mild version. I'm not talking about something that I'm not trying to liken this to racism in any way. I'm just like, I guess I have experienced that idea of having to change up the way you behave. And to be honest, I think I probably in those early years ended up saying things that I'm not particularly pleased about. I think if you're a decent person, you look back and you go, you know, the world has changed in a massive way. The way we talk about women has changed, hopefully, you know, the way we talk about race is changing, hopefully even in this conversation and stuff. And you just go, I wouldn't talk to or about women in the same way that I did when I was in my early 20s. And not just because I'm older, but because the world has changed. And you just go, why was that okay? You know, so, I look back on a fair bit of that with regret and just, you just shrug and think, well, it was the world.
Do you think that impacted your ability to succeed in the game in any way, shape or form in terms of like your sense of belonging or how much mental, you know, fortitude you could apply to being a footballer if you're worried about other things in the wider context or the actual changing room or the culture? Did that impact your ability to like mentally apply yourself?
I actually think that I trained with Bury, my hometown. I trained with Bury FC before I actually started playing semi-pro. This is not about Bury FC. This is in every football changing room in the country. And I didn't do very well and played entirely within myself the entire time, when I was training with them. And I remain to this day convinced that that was because I didn't express myself and have the confidence that I should have done, on the pitch and off it really. And, if I'd have had the experience of having to go through that in the semi-pro world and then had that trait, it might have been different because I'd built this sort of carapace now of just like, yeah, whatever, nothing bothers me in that way that you had to. So I think it definitely, in that respect, because I was so kind of not used to it, and I hadn't got used to switching the way I behaved. I think it absolutely cost me. I think that, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that I would have been, I would have played 100 games for Man United or anything, but like it definitely in that trial, I definitely played within myself and felt that I couldn't come out and express the way I wanted to be and to play and be as a person.
What's really interesting is that, and again, this applies to a multitude of spaces, but like ultimately you're saying, you know, you came in as a person into the culture of football, you observed it and you got into your own head. And you didn't perform to what you believe is the best of your ability. And that's just in the realm of football. And obviously you've still managed to create a career of yourself. You've obviously done very well, but like there is that thing. And I think sometimes when we're trying to explain to not really people who are trying to understand, it's usually people that are firm. They just choose not to understand. You try to explain the impact of an environment on somebody. Because when the environment rules are set by you and your parents and, you know, they move you around and it's like, go work at that place and go work at that place and call this person, he'll give you a job, you know, that elite level of access and the next level down, which benefits from all of those things. And sometimes, you know, as a black person, you start explaining, you know, just like the contextually what it's like. And for me, I will never forget, like I used to go into, I worked in advertising for 15 years and I'd go into work on a Monday and I hated it because I knew that the how was your weekend questions was going to leave a mile difference between, you know, what I was doing and what they were doing. And it's not a, it's not necessarily like a malicious question, and it's not something that's trying to expose anything. They're actually trying to connect. But it was the lack of awareness of how different, you know, our weekends would be. And then even the desire to want to know without like, and having the skill and the language to like talk to me about my weekend without it sounding like I'm being othered was fundamentally important. And I remember around about the George Floyd time, and I was helping out an agency for a few weeks, and we'd do a call every Monday. It was 9 to 9:30. We'll all just do a little 2-3 minutes on what we've done this weekend. And everyone was going around. It was like, oh, I decorated my house. Oh, I moved. Oh, you know, just like, you know, I went for a run, just different things. And they were like, oh, Marvin, what did you do? And I was like, well, I was deciding whether I should go out and risk my physical health with COVID and try and protest for my also physical health around racial identity.
Yes, so, you know,
and the fact is they had no idea that could potentially even be my answer, because everyone was like, oh, right, okay. Or they must have thought potentially I wasn't that type of person who was, you know, they probably othered the people who were on TV, because the narrative of the time was like, look at these, you know, young people and black people who are, and you know, these liberals running outside to protest racial justice in the middle of a pandemic. And they felt like that was the most urgent and important thing. And it's just like, we're still fighting for our lives no matter what. So let's fight. And I found that really, that's a really interesting experience to kind of to sit in and live with, is that often when we're trying to explain the things that happen, how things chip away at you, and it creates a condition where mentally you just don't feel at your best to deliver. And that, you know, then when we show up to certain places or certain rooms or certain levels of business or whatever, we're already holding the weight of all of those things before we've even walked into a room. We actually are representing, you know, your whole race at that point, because it's like, oh, we brought a black person in and they weren't that good, actually. They're a bit moody, and you know, like
that never really occurred to me. It's like there's that added kind of like, you've got to perform that 10% better so that people don't go, we had a black guy and they weren't that great, as if like everybody's the same. You know, it was one of the things I was thinking about how we were going to talk as well, and I was not worried but I just wanted to kind of make sure that I didn't speak to you in a way that was to go, right, well, you now speak for all black people. I think that's another mistake that white people make as well, in good conscience, you know, when they go, okay, so tell me what it's like. It's like, well, yeah, you can tell what it's like for you, but like it's a sort of almost a disrespectful thing to assume that there's one person who's like, right, well, I'm Mr. Black person, and this is what we all know. I wanted to say this about football. You reminded me of something that I observed back at the time, and it shows how times have changed. When everybody on that team was friends, right? I'm pleased to say I don't have an example of going, oh, it was awful. I turned up to football and there were 5 black lads on the team and they were treated really bad. No, not at all. Everybody was treated, and I use this in inverted commas, equally, right? You know, within the boundaries of what society is and was. And we all turned up for training and your Tuesdays and Thursday nights, and you'd get changed. People sort of come in, arrive in dribs and drabs, and you'd start at 7:30. So from anywhere between like 6:45 to 7:30, there'd be 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people out on the field, and you'd be pinging a ball to each other and warming up, waiting for training to start. After a few weeks, I noticed that without fail, even though everyone would have banter in the changing rooms and have a laugh and then probably have a drink together afterwards, you'd walk out and the people would be kicking a ball in a circle, and there'd be a circle of more white guys and 4 or 5 black lads. I think that was about, it wasn't that the black lads had been told they weren't welcome to come and join in. They had instinctively chosen to go and kick the ball amongst themselves. And I remember thinking, what a strange choice. And I remember sort of slightly, I guess, making that their problem, going, what a strange choice that they've decided, you know, they're more than welcome to why don't they join in? And I look back now, and it's that whole thing about going, you know, racism is not black people's problem. It's a white person problem that affects black people. And it's like, I wish so much now that I would have just walked over and joined in with the black guys, just to break that pattern.
I think those are the moments where it's not necessarily an act of kindness in a patronizing way, but it's just an act of humanity, isn't it? You've made an observation that there's some sort of divide around racial gender lines, And you know, by just standing there, you can create a statement. And it's not something that you would then turn around and be like, ah, do you know what I did? It's just by just standing there.
Exactly. Yeah.
By being there. Yeah. Then you open up the door. I don't know if you've seen the film, Remember the Titans, with Denzel Washington.
Yeah,
Beautiful film of like how harmony can happen by just having, you know, one or two people. It doesn't even have to be the alpha person within that, you know, the lead person. It actually can just be, I think there was a guy, it was called Sunshine. And I think he arrives from an army training camp and he throws the ball at the other quarterback, the white quarterback. And then he crosses the lines and they start, you know, connecting on music. And then there's a larger guy that comes and he starts connecting. And before you know it, you visually just created like an idea of what can happen when you cross.
It's the optics. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's important to note though that like it's complicated for white people who want to do the right thing, because those guys, to my knowledge, by the way, who knows, but those guys on that football team, no one was being, you know, no one was excluding them. It was just in that moment when you would walk out and they instinctively went over to one side. And I don't know. I guess I do know why. I'm starting to understand why culturally that they felt the need to do that. But like, it's difficult because I think the reason I thought, why are they doing that? Why aren't they coming over? Was because I was confused because they weren't excluded in the change room, and we all were friends and we all sort of bought each other drinks afterwards and all that kind of thing. So I don't know. I made the observation. I just didn't quite know how to respond to it.
But I think this is where the power of having people in your life around you to ask these questions. So like that, obviously in that moment, you've missed the opportunity, but now it's in your head. If you have proximity to people from any community or any intersection, you know, then you can ask them, you know, what would I do? Same thing for women. If you saw someone, you know, being quite flirtatious with a woman and she didn't like it and he's grabbing her arm or whatever, you might have allowed it to go that one time, but then you'd go home and ask any woman in your life. It's like, what would you want me to do? And then this is why proximity creates affinity to different groups. So if you have somebody, then you have an affinity to them because you understand what that means. Mm-hmm. You understand why those guys are playing on their own. And it could have been something as simple as just safety and affinity. Mm. And, you know, normally whenever we're in, you know, it's an internal understood known thing within our community that if you go to somewhere and you see a black person, you know, you're trying to look for them for that affinity to be like, we can get through this together. And we can figure out the landscape.
My friend Simon calls it the nod.
Yes. It's the most universal concept. We're just looking at you like, am I going to get it? Am I going to get it?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now you understand. Yeah. I'll come and sit next to you. The other thing I wanted to say is that even within the football context, because what's really interesting is that, because we're talking about the racial divide on a playing level, for example, the culture in a changing room. But there's also this other layer, which is like the manager and the chairman and what they do. And we look at, like, I saw the other day that Liverpool, I don't know if it was leaked or if it was announced, but the wages and salaries of their top players was announced. And you look at someone like Salah, and there is a divide between, I know he's African, but there is a divide between northern countries of Africa and the sub-Saharan Africa. Even the idea of sub-Saharan Africa is quite offensive because the whole thing is Africa. Mm-hmm. You know, Mane was earning, I think, 30% to what Salah was. I think Salah was on 285,000 a week.
You're joking. I didn't know that.
Was on, I think it was 90 or 100 a week. And you look at that divide, and this is where like structural things happen. Because ultimately, if you think about player for player, on any given day, you could swap them out and you could have a fair conversation as to who you would want.
Even if you think Salah's better, he's not three times better.
No. And so you then look at the impact of, you know, sometimes how people present, they might present like it's on the ground. Me and you are on the same team. We're having a great time. But then we both go in for contract renegotiations. And then, you know, the feedback that the manager gets in terms of understanding you as a player, as a culture. And you see it all the time in the Premier League. And I don't want to discredit, you know, if they're good or not, but there's players that are culturally very British in how they play. And that gets celebrated in a way that any other player wouldn't get celebrated. And so there's no, I always think of like, I'm going to say these people's name, but they've also very successful. So I don't want to diminish their success, but people like Mason Mount and people like Jordan Henderson and people like James Milner, you know, they are good players, but they're good players. They're reliable, good players. But the way they're spoken about as if they're, you know, they are the absolute affinity or the example of great leaders and great players, I think sometimes it's slightly oversold. And it's really difficult how, I'll never forget how they had a snippet of Yaya Toure's commentary and how he was being spoken about over the seasons. And they would never talk about his intelligence. It was power.
Oh, yes,
pace,
I've heard about it. Yeah, it's always, skill. Yeah, all black players, it's all like, oh, like Lukaku. Oh, he's a beast. Oh, he's so strong. He's so,
yeah.
And it's never like, oh, my, he's so skillful. Yeah. When you look at Mane, and he's unbelievably skillful. Exactly. Yeah.
But also very intelligent. To create the things he creates, it requires an element of football intelligence. And I think this is the type of the narrative that I think ultimately shapes some of the things that may happen in the actual squad level, because there may be a bit more harmony in the squad. And we've seen that with Black Lives Matter, probably more than ever. We've seen players standing with the rest of their players. And obviously the clubs that haven't are the obvious clubs that we've all known. But like, I think, what happens structurally in terms of, coaching and management and, contract levels and like extensions and, how people feel like people are performing and not understanding some of the things that may impact, people on a different level. So it's really a difficult thing. And I think what I'm supposed to be sharing with you is just, how people show up isn't necessarily the full story. But when we're trying to paint this picture of how things disconnect, it's not always the person like you who might be in my team with me. There's another level, there's a socialized level, but there's a structural level that can ultimately impact a lot of these conversations.
What's really weird about that thing about Liverpool is that, you would think that above almost so many other things, that football is a meritocracy. I don't see Mo Salah being three times better than Mane. How could that have come about? Because does Mane have an agent that people don't respect as much? Does he have an African agent? I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah. And so then for you, in terms of like the things that you've seen, obviously in terms of acting, which is another world. And I think acting has always been great at being one of the first. The acting, music usually leads the way in terms of like cultural shifts. Sport does the same at cultural shifts, because ultimately you're almost, the stories end up creating stars and moments and narratives that shape things. So, there's usually a lot more integration in acting. Have you ever observed anything in acting or in casting or roles that you've been put out for? And, have you ever gone to a casting for something and seen that there's black people and white people up for the same role? Or has it always, those type of things, I think people would never really know.
Well, it's an interesting, that whole kind of area is interesting and people are trying to find their way through it now, because there was a thing about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, that people were calling it colorblind casting in a very sort of progressive way. And then that changed, and it was like, wait, colorblind casting is deeply problematic anyway, because that then you're talking about not acknowledging a particular individual's culture and ancestry and heritage. So then it became color conscious casting, which I think is a much more inclusive idea. But it is funny, isn't it? Because up until relatively recently, I might have gone, yeah, I know, it's really great, but like, you'd want to cast this film. But the fact is, historically, I mean, I wouldn't have made that argument, because it's a dumb argument and nothing changes that way. But what I'm trying to get to is this idea that like, Bridgerton, for example, has completely exploded all of those myths. It's like, yeah, we'll just do a period drama and cast whoever we want, as in fact did Hamilton, And suddenly you go, all right, okay, it's entirely doable, and no one needs to make those excuses anymore. Now, I did a TV show called The Cafe that I wrote and was in it, and I wrote it and I, cast it. And in the second series, it was set in Weston-super-Mare in Somerset. And 2010, we made it. And we were like, do you know what? It was about three generations of women trying to keep a cafe open. And it was a gentle comedy. And the second series, we were like, I can't believe that we haven't got a black character in. We really should write a black character. And we did. And I cast my friend Cobner Holbrook-Smith. Do you know him? He played, Cobner? Yeah. Cobner's a legend. And I was in a play with him a couple of years previously, and we cast him. And he was brilliant. And what we wanted to do, as forward-thinking liberals making this show, we wanted to, we were like, the thing is, there's almost like no black people in Weston-super-Mare. So if he arrives in the cafe, somebody will have an opinion on that. So we have to address that. So what we had him doing, he arrives in the cafe and he's in Weston-super-Mare and he's doing community service. Now, but that's a deliberate, like we were selling people a misdirection there, because the idea is he was doing community service, but you find out in later episodes that it's not because he's a criminal. It's because he beat up, I think it was like he beat up three neo-Nazis who were attacking someone outside a gay nightclub, right? So technically he's a criminal because he's doing community service, but the idea was, we're going to confound your expectations. He's not what you, this is not what you think, and so on and so on. I look back at that now and I go, I don't know. I don't know if it was the right way to go. What might have been the right way to go is just to have him come in and just be in the world, you know, and not gone, well, he's black, so we've got to act. Not, you know, I wish I'd just gone, well, if in Weston-super-Mare, they wouldn't have, somebody would have said something. That's their problem. No, I don't mean Weston-super-Mare. If anyone's listening from Weston-super-Mare, I'm not slugging you off. I mean those characters.
No, we are.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. Never go to Weston-super-Mare. No, it'd be very good to be Weston-super-Mare. Do you know what I mean? And that was 11 years ago now. And I look back and I go, I don't know if it was the right, it was certainly the most well-intentioned. And I don't think it was, it's not for me to say what's offensive, but I don't think it was offensive. But I wish that instead we'd have just not even made any deal of it and he'd have come in and had a whole different storyline so that we didn't have to have that acknowledgement.
That's a common thing. And so, you know, how intentional are you with casting? How intentional are you with storylines and contextualizing people? Do you want to be like, hey, look, we're addressing this thing, or do you just want it just to be slipped in and be normal? So I think for every Bridgerton, I think there's like the other side of it is like a Scarlett Johansson who believes she can play any person on the planet and it's perfectly fine. And I think, you know, and I think in essence, I can understand the argument from an actor's point of view in terms of like wanting to play anything. You want to be able to play a mermaid, you want to be a voice in a, you know, in a cartoon, you want to play any woman of any kind. But I also then think it's like the impact on the people watching and the impact of the conversation that is being driven, it was incredibly self-centered to only consider your desire to act above everything else that was being said and done. And I think there'll be plenty of time, you know, Scarlett will work until the very last day that she chooses to. And so, you know, she can pick anything she wants to. She's not on the realm of like struggling actor mode where, you know, she's talking about her freedom to perform any context that she wants. And I was like, what a fantastic joy and privilege that you can just play an East Asian woman in a film, knowing that there are East Asian women who credibly could play themselves very, very well. And I think, you know, when we're talking about an attempt to do something thoughtful, you may get it wrong. And that's, you know, that happens. And I think also just like, I call it being about being on the court. If you're on the court on the issue of racism, you may make mistakes, but who are you when you get caught with the mistake? And like, did you do enough due diligence to ensure that you didn't? You know, Covenant's a great guy, so I assume he had some sort of viewpoint input on it. He probably bought into the idea on some level. So therefore, you've spoken to him about it, or you may have spoken to someone about it and landed at the conclusion. And it may not have worked. But I think once you put your hand up and be like, look, we tried and it was the wrong thing to try, but my next attempt will be more based on what I've learned and understood from that. And you just keep going. That's really, really powerful. But I think when you just own this kind of like space and you just decide on behalf of everybody else what your approach is going to be, I think that's when it becomes really problematic, because we would never do that for gender. We would never do that around LGBTQIA+. We would actually listen to the community and take a stance. And if you get it wrong, as if you dropped something in your mum's house, you'd be like, oops, I'm so sorry, and you'll clean it up. You wouldn't just be like, yeah. I was getting my own food. And so
I was getting my own food. Yeah. So give me credit, clean that up, mum. Yeah. No, I know. I think, you know, people trot this out as too easily as an excuse. And I think it's not an excuse, but it's also, but it can be context. Like the world, people say the world was a different place. Now, that only goes so far, because you can't have been mistreating people because the world's a different place. But you can, when I look back at that idea with casting Cobner and writing that storyline, I don't think it was offensive, and it was certainly well-intentioned, but also the world was a different place. And Cobner did buy into that very happily. He was like, yeah, it's lovely because I get to come in and I get to show. And certainly Cobner didn't flag it up. Now, it's only then when you look back, you go, well, maybe Cobner didn't flag it up, because at the time we lived in a world in 2010 where he was like, this isn't really something we flag up. We just go, thanks for your good intentions, and we take the money and we pay our mortgage and we go, thank you. You know, and it's that kind of thing as well that I think well-intentioned white people have to now think and just go talk to people like you without going, please teach me about what race is. Do you know what I mean? You've got to try and find the way to, because the problem is if they don't, then it's not enough to go, well, I think it's awful now, but I better not say anything because otherwise nothing changes, right? So yes, the world was a different place. I don't think we did anything massively offensive, but I probably would think differently about that now, or even cast somebody first and then consult them about how they thought about it first. I think we'd written the part first. Listen, there's another thing, and I don't want anyone to sort of pick up on this and then have a massive headline about it. But yeah, there's another thing about casting that we should talk about, but I almost don't want to get into too much because I think there's a whole hour on this and I think it's a whole different conversation. I don't know if you remember, but there was this outcry when about 5 years or 4 years ago, there was a short 25-minute comedy short made by Sky where Brian Cox played Marlon Brando, Stocker Channing played Elizabeth Taylor, and Joseph Fiennes played Michael Jackson in 2001 on September the 11th. Well, I produced that. I cast it. Well, I was part of that decision. Now, clearly, that was a terrible idea. But first of all, it felt complicated because, in fact, to be honest, it didn't even feel complicated. Michael Jackson, I mean, I understand now. I'm not necessarily asking you to explain. I listened to everybody when they were furious. But like, it was sort of best intentions in that, like, Michael Jackson in 2001 was a complicated individual to represent. And in the way he looked, his face was white and so on and so on. So we asked casting directors, we asked everyone, and at no point, like, big casting directors gave us lists of who could play him. Not a single black person on that list. Not a single mixed race person on that list. And that's really, really interesting and entirely wrong. But the world was a different place. And now 5 years later, you go, you can't do that. But I guess before I ask you, I'll tell you something that annoyed me about that whole thing was that whole episode. And this is the first time I've ever talked about it. There was a massive outcry. Two things. Well, the main thing about the massive outcry was, this is a disgrace. Pull it. Don't show the show. And that's fine. No problem. But there were a lot of people left confused, a lot of people in power in casting. Remember I said, like, the big casting directors, a lot of people in production, and even to an extent me going, I don't quite know. I know that this is wrong, but I don't quite know why. And I don't. And the problem is because what should have happened was there should have been probably a online sit down, not even debate, because no one's going to go, I think I'm right, tell me what. But people might go, please tell me from your point of view exactly why this is offensive. Because if we don't, nothing gets better, right? No, you know, it takes another 5 years before anything kind of changes. So I'm not saying to you what I did wrong, but like, because I know, but like, what's your take on that whole thing?
I think what's really interesting, because I remember it at the time and I didn't internalize too much of it, because I think one of the things I realized as a black person is that every week there's a new episode of ridiculousness regarding our lived experience. But what I will say about that is that I think if you think about Michael Jackson, he is unquestionably a black man. And I think if you think about the era which he grew up with and the era which he became successful in, and what the context was for him, it could be partially health related. It could be, you know, in terms of how he then developed that onwards, it definitely is about, you know, his proximity to whiteness in terms of what he then evolved himself to look into. And in many ways that's a mental challenge. That's somebody that isn't okay with how they are and who they are and what they look like and what they represent. And I think that, you know, if you think about the context in which Michael Jackson exists in and the level of success and fame he got to, in many ways, the erasure of him as a black man, as that person in that moment, is incredibly problematic. It's almost like he's a symptom of the structure which we're constantly trying to articulate to non-black people, that it has an incredible and profound amount of impact. So think about the messaging he received. Again, take your football analogy into account. And that's him in the music context.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And he's going places, and, you know, I'm pretty sure when he first started performing, there were places where he had to get in the back door, or, you know, black people weren't really allowed, or they hadn't performed before. He was creating firsts. And then what that represents in terms of the level of fame he went to, being one of the largest artists in the world, and then still, you know, then having himself questioned in that context. So when we get to the point of portraying him, and again, he wasn't even, I believe he wasn't the center of the story. He was a character within the context of it. And so I think, you know, in essence, the erasure of his blackness is a fundamental important thing, because in even him being there is a huge statement. Like, standing next to Elizabeth Taylor is an incredible statement to reach that level of fame where he comes from. And so to not make him black changes the context of whoever's there. I think the other thing is that when we think about, you know, you're speaking to the industry, it speaks to what we talk about, structural and institutional racism, in terms of, because I think when people say racism, they think it's like someone with a pickaxe hitting, like knocking people over the head and being like, you must die. And sometimes, and again, it's sometimes it's a lot simpler. And this is the nicest, kindest version of structural racism, where it's like, if you have, you know, the same people, five people from the same intersection representing business in an industry, their values and likeness are what, and their lens in terms of what the world is what then becomes. So there's a talent agent, a studio, production, an actor. That is now their lens about what is possible and what isn't possible in a production. So, you know, asking them and the children of them, or the, you know, affiliates of them about something like this, you're probably going to get versions of the same answer. But also, as you know, a lot of these kind of industries, same thing with music, is operated on fear, because nobody wants to put their hands up and be like, this is a really bad idea. It happens in advertising. In my industry, you know, there'll be content. We looked at Pepsi when they did the advert with Kylie Jenner, when she was like handing Pepsi out to police brutality, you know, police who were brutalizing protesters. It just was like, why did no one just be like, that's a terrible visual representation? And it's because everybody in that chain, from Pepsi down to, you know, the advertising agency, down to the people who even featured in it, nobody thought that this looks nuts. And then you think, how many people were being complicit? It's not, and again, inaction is still a really massive problem, because, you know, you had the well intentions, and you probably would have heard the criticism if somebody said, that's an absurd idea. An alarm may have gone off in your head. But the fact is, because of the place, the space you held in terms of pushing for, you as a decision maker on the production, people may not have challenged you or asked a question. And so sometimes, like, just by being a white male, regardless of what the actual content of your character is, it feeds into what people just assume you will be like, and they just don't want to go up against it, because if you ever did was become an arsehole and then turn your power onto an individual who challenged you, what the consequences will be. So I'm not saying that every single time these things happen it's evil white man does something and where are all the consequences of it. Sometimes the culture is just created by a consistent log of events that happen that nobody, people just want to pay their rent. And sometimes you don't want to be the pro-black, pro-woman, pro-LGBTQI+ on the set. You just want to act and you want to go home like other people do. And I feel like this condition can only be stopped by those people. Like, you have to, like, you know, sometimes even me as a business leader, I have to stop and go to my team and be like, if we are doing something wrong, say something. Because again, me, even as a male, as a black male, in the context of blackness, we are the top of the, you know, ecosystem in terms of blackness. And so sometimes LGBTQI voices or disabled voices or female voices aren't heard. And so if I don't go back in and be like, you can challenge me on this and make that environment safe for that to happen, the continuation of these problems will continue.
It's interesting. I'm thinking about it now. And what it is, I think, is that, so Joseph Fiennes as well, should get a mention here to be like, when he took that on, I guess what I'm just trying to say is, everybody had not even the best intentions. Nobody even thought that this was going to be a problem, right? It would never occur to anyone. And that is exactly what you're talking about. That's the problem. Or if it did occur to people, they thought, I'd better not say anything because I just want to take my paycheck and go home, right? But, you know, I certainly want to make sure that, you know, people aren't listening thinking, well, what was Joseph Fiennes thinking? He wasn't thinking anything. Everybody just thought, in 2001, Michael Jackson was appeared to be white. And actually, there was this very early on, there was this one idea of going, well, it'd be really, really insulting to like cast a black guy and then put white makeup on them. So we were like, oh, we can't do that. I look back now and you kind of think, maybe we should. Maybe we should have talked to somebody, actually, but we didn't think it was that much of a big deal. Anyway, so what's becoming clear to me now, in a way that nobody's ever really expressed before, and I think I can take away from this, and hopefully this helps people, you know, every one of your black listeners knows this already, but any white listeners might not know this, and this is why I'm hoping that this is useful for us. It had never occurred to any of us on that show that Michael Jackson may have appeared to be white in 2001. And we talk about mental health in a much more open way now than we did even 5 years ago. So there's that too, right? So maybe it was his mental health, maybe it was his proximity to whiteness that made him feel like he had to change his appearance. To us, he you know, he's just this absolute legend that was a bit bonkers and now look what he looks like, right? But it never occurred to us, I suppose, that to millions, billions of black people during the 70s and 80s, when there were so few icons, you know, when there were so few people to kind of go, that's my hero. He was this black guy moving at the, not even that, moving amongst the sort of elite circles. He was the top of the tree. And when you, I guess that's a part of white privilege, is when you grow up and everyone you see, every superhero, every, you know, this is way before Black Panther, every superhero and everyone you see, apart from Blade, I guess, but,
people don't count him as the first Marvel, by the way. They feel like that was like Blade, it was great, and then it's over there. And then like Marvel,
I know, it's mad.
It's like he made Marvel
exactly,
possible.
Exactly. Yeah. Blade is Marvel. Okay. Let's not see it. But, I guess, you know, all of my heroes, or even Indiana Jones, Arnold Schwarzenegger, whatever, I've grown up and all my heroes are look like me. Well, not so much Schwarzenegger, but I'm working on it.
I read the articles. Yeah, sorry, I saw the pictures.
Yeah. I guess it didn't occur to any of us that to take somebody who, not just people are like, well, I like him because he's a hero of mine, who's like represented in certain respects, one of the only handful of heroes that black culture had. Yeah. It never occurred to any of us. And I think, you know, I've known vaguely as I've tried to think about these things that that's what it is. But yes, it's that kind of like, it's too important to, yeah, it was too important a symbol to co-opt, I guess, if that's the right way of putting it. So yeah, I mean, I didn't kind of come on here with the intention of going like mea culpa or anything, and I hope that's not what it is. But it's like, I think that whole issue was never really properly unpacked, you know. And I hope it sort of has been a little bit more, because if you don't unpack these things and kind of go, okay, well, let's figure this out, then nothing gets better.
And the thing is that I, in many ways, yeah, because it's always interesting to, when these experiences happen and there is a rapid response to something that happens, it's considered called anti-blackness. And again, it's like when these things happen, you very rarely get a chance to actually connect with someone who's involved in it. And when you do get a chance, it's actually just a really good opportunity to hear the thought process, because often, when things are reported, it's always hugely structural. And sometimes it's almost painted as if, from within our community, as if there is like architects of this ridiculousness. Cause, you know, some, like, you know, you hear about Gucci and they do like a Jamaica jumper, which is not the Jamaica flag. It's actually Rastafarianism, and they call it the Jamaica jumper and they sell it for £2,000. And we're just like, what the fudge are you doing? Whose decision making is this? And sometimes these things happen so often, these mishaps. Culturally, you just start to just get, you don't even bother to dig into why. It's now just like nobody's listening to the things that we're doing. And obviously, because understanding you now and listening to you for the last hour in terms of like what your experiences and what your observations are, and then connecting it, I think people can also see sometimes these are just human errors that then get structuralized. at a really large level. But I think, you know, now that you have the awareness of how these things can be seen or portrayed or inclusive, you talked about the Cobner example, you talked about speaking to people outside. I think there's almost like a moment where you can then become a beacon of that thinking in any room that you're in. So if people are representing blackness in a way, like, you know, you can actually just challenge and be like, I don't think that's right. And I think that will cause a lot of challenges, because as much as acting is progressing, there are still so many gaps and there's still decisions being made without people of color in, or the intersection of which they're trying to represent in. And then that creates significant amount of challenges.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my big takeaway from talking to you is that, well, what you just said then about that example, the Michael Jackson thing, was like, you know, what the thought process was. And actually what's most interesting is that there wasn't a thought process, you know, like it was, you said it's like inaction can often be, you know, a real problem, because nobody in that cast or crew or even high up at Sky, nobody was, anything other than well intentioned. It just wasn't thought about. And if that's what changes, then good. You know, that's why we're having this conversation. That's part of it. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was, because since last year, since George Floyd, and I've been trying to think about what allyship means. And I sort of used to think it means, well, you know, I've got loads of black friends and I'm not racist. And I try and cast them in, you know, in 2010 in a show, I wrote a part for a black person for that very reason, blah, blah, blah. But no, that's not right. It's not, you know, and it's okay that, you know, you're trying, but this feels like a really good moment to learn and do things better. Which is why I wanted to talk to you. But, and also because, like you say, the more white people, especially white people in positions of power, go, okay, well, let's figure this out. Let's talk about this. Then hopefully it starts to, the dam starts to burst, or whatever analogy you want to use. It must be exhausting. You know what you just said? It's like, sometimes you just go, it's just so many of these happens every day. Then you just get kind of fatigued with it all. And then it's easier just to, just be angry all the time. And
I think the key thing is what we're asking for in response, and I said this in the beginning, is just that humility of the error. And I think so many errors happen because, you know, if you're on the court and everyone's running around a football pitch, you're going to bump into someone. Now you can sit there and be like, get out of my way. Or you can sit there and be like, oh, I didn't mean to bump into you. And you can be more conscious of where you're running next time. And I think quite often what happens, especially around racial identity, there's this almost just like upright denial that anything is any different. And we've seen the conversation. We've seen the race report that came out last week. There's all these, you know, Piers Morgan 2 weeks ago. There's all these huge things that seem to happen that drive a significant amount of, you know, insight. And again, like, and this is again referenced in terms of like the Michael Jackson casting, is that when Meghan Markle was first, you know, introduced as a partner for Harry, and This Morning is doing a piece on lookalikes, they just chose a white girl. They didn't understand the importance of choosing someone with the correct ethnicity. They just put a ginger man with a white brunette and was just like, that's them. They look just like them, don't they? Yes, they do. And we're just sitting there at TV and just thinking, this is why this show is just so outdated. And it hasn't grown up. It hasn't matured. It hasn't updated itself. It still lives in that bubble. And I think those types of things happen so often in terms of just representing actual people authentically. And all it really requires is to actually communicate to those people, have those people in the room, have those people have a chance to feed back into the process. And because, again, when you have the power, you don't want to relinquish that power. Because then even you as a casting director saying that you have to defer to somebody else, how, you know, that removes power from you as an individual. It's this very selfish notion of like, if I am not the be all expert on this subject, then, you know, people will just go to the other person next time and just ask that person. And they never consider that actually you have enough power and experience and access to be able to do your job at a high level and still use people to leverage that insight. And in no other industry would you do that. You know, you wouldn't as a scientist ignore a biologist when you're trying to change one idea into another and just be like, oh no, we don't want to get a biologist because then everyone's going to invest in biologists. It's like, no, you say the mission is the most important thing. And if we want to make an incredible piece of content that everybody wants to love, watch and share, we need to have these people around in the room to pose that question.
Here at B&Q, we've launched our brand new website, DIY.ie. Browse thousands of products available for home delivery and 1 hour click and collect. Visit DIY.ie today. You can do it when you B&Q it. Delivery and click and collect available on selected products and locations. Restrictions apply. Delivery charges may apply. See DIY.ie.
This idea about allyship is such an important, it's a really important thing. And I suppose I'll read them out. And if anything lands to you, I'd love to hear your thoughts on them. But I think like when to be an ally is about taking the struggle on as your own, which is really important in terms of understanding that something isn't right and owning it as in I can do something about it and looking for opportunities where you can add value or change the conversation or challenge things. And I think we've had some examples already today. I think transferring, you know, your privilege over to others, I think that, you know, again, that's like in that particular role, you know, is there a thing with Cobner, for example, that you could have that you could have platformed and said, actually, we're going to make Cobner a co-producer on this. And that would have helped him with a producer credit, but it also would have given him a chance to at the table fairly say like what he feels is going to drive this episode and make it land in a way that our audiences would have had affinity to it and come and watched it. You could have increased your audience pool. And then the next one is about amplifying the voices of oppressed people before your own. So again, like, you know, platforming people to your platforms and just saying, come and have a free conversation about this. You know, I remember at the time there was a podcast that reached out to me, quite a prominent podcast, and they were like, Marvin, we'd love you to come on. And then I was like, yeah, let's catch up next week. And then that week happened. And then because the news had changed, all of a sudden it was slightly less important and I never heard from them again. And you know, that type of thing is where we, you know, that trust and affinity gets broken. But, you know, it's so powerful. I think even us, we've platformed challenges around women. We've had women come and just talk freely and just post a podcast with none of us on it, just using our audience to go out and have this conversation about women. We did the same for with Pride Month. And we just sometimes allowing people to have space on your platform just to say the things that are ultimately important is incredibly powerful. And then acknowledge that even though you feel pain, the conversation is not about you.
For a start, that's why I'm glad that we're talking and I wanted to talk to you because like it's all very well when it's all happening, Black Lives Matter and the protests are happening going, hey, should we, you know, is there any way I could support this to talk? But that's why it was a year later. And I was like, listen, just, it was a real offer. I'd love to talk to you. So, you know, yay me. But more importantly, if you'd like to come and talk about this stuff on my podcast as well, it doesn't have to be like, you know, I come to talk to a black guy because it's important to talk about this. It's like, well, let's get Marvin on to talk to me and Will. You know, me and Will reach, I'm sure there are some black guys that listen to us, black people that listen to us, but I think that our audience is predominantly, I guess, actually, I don't quite know what our audience is, but I guess it's predominantly white working class guys who grew up watching our show. So, you know, I think this is really, it would be great to if that's the kind of thing that you're interested in when we get a couple of episodes down the line, I think we absolutely should.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it. I think the, and then the other thing is, number four is about when we say acknowledge, and acknowledge that even though you feel pain, the conversation's about you. Again, even if we take it out of the allyship as a concept is anybody. So if you think about, you know, going to someone and someone saying, I've got cancer, and we talked about this earlier, and then you saying like, well, I thought I had cancer once. And it's like, you would never do that. You would never center their pain as your own. You would 100% platform and allow them to have that feeling, express their concerns, and then try to reassure them the best you can. And I think often when we talk about racism, it's like, it's never to be like, oh, and I was hurt once too. So, you know, being fat is like the same as being called the N-word because, you know, I can't help my weight. You can't help being black. You know, even just in conversation, it's just like clunky. So never to do those types of things. And I think stand up even when you feel scared. And I think, again, this is about, you know, the power you may have internally. And again, this doesn't make people devoid of, your own personal things, because if you don't have confidence in general, and every day is a battle for you in terms of confidence because you don't like something about yourself or you've been bullied as a child, you know, doesn't make it just easy because you're white that you can stand in that room and say something. But what you don't realize is how powerful your voice in that conversation is, and actually you can not only change the outcome of that thing. So the cost of you being brave internally is a lot, and we're acknowledging that, but the power in which you have to drive the conversation or change the mood around anything by just putting your hand up and asking the question. And it could be something very subtle. Is that, you know, is that right? Do you think that's going to work? Poses a question to the whole room and be like, I feel like that could be really problematic. You know, just a sentence that you can give, that you can arm yourself with, that drives the conversation, is really, really helpful about how we can kind of challenge the things that we think are happening around us. And then the next one is about own your mistakes and decenter yourself. So I think this is a common thing with people, is like this opinion culture, the debate culture, which is where, you know, people are talking and they have a debate and they have an opposing view, and they feel like if you disagree with the person, you're disagreeing with them. And actually, like, you don't own your views. Your view is just a viewpoint. If I think I'm going to vote Labour and you think we should vote Conservative, I don't want to put that in your name in case that comes to soundbite, but I don't know. Don't want to get in trouble. So the point is, if your views could be economically conservative, but then ultimately you could be more of a socialist in terms of your day-to-day interactions. And, you know, if your view on economic conservatism is a thing, it shouldn't then mean that you are. And it shouldn't be the end of the conversation and our ability to share space. It's really about making sure that whenever we own a mistake or anything we've said that may, challenge somebody else or impede somebody else's progress, that actually it's not always just about what you feel and what your beliefs are. It's like your beliefs are here, my beliefs are here, we compare them, they're different, and then we, you know, go our separate ways. We don't have to make them like I disagree with you. And I think the last thing is that understanding your education is up to you and no one else. And I think you've mentioned this a few times, like we're having this conversation, so in the realm of this conversation, I've already accepted that there may be some questions that you want to ask, and you can ask them because you've accepted the invite. There's a whole nother thing is if you message me in my inbox and be like, Marvin, could you explain structural racism to me, please? I really don't understand. That's a completely different way to approach it. And now we have this relationship. If you just wanted to, like, Marvin, actually, I do have a question, and you know, we are doing this production and we are speaking to these people, what do you think would be a really good way to do it? We now have, you know, proximity. We have an affinity now. So it becomes less of a labor to have that conversation. But I think, you know, these are the types of, when we talk about guide to allyships, those are the 7 steps, and we'll make sure we publish them and share them alongside this episode, because I think it's really, really important that we all start to dig in and understand. When I was going through there, did anything come up for you?
Yeah, loads. I mean, for a start, it all makes a lot of sense, which is a good start. I think, you know, owning your mistakes is a difficult one, not a difficult one, but owning the mistakes, the things that I think hold people back are owning mistakes, because they're afraid if they own up to mistakes, then they'll get in trouble in some way. Like, you know, you don't want to, like, I was not nervous, but I was like, it's a little daunting to come on here and talk to you about any of this stuff. And I had no idea what we were going to talk about, but you're just like, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a couple of sound bites here and then I'll get a few people on Twitter, who knows what they'll be saying. I'll be accused of virtue signaling and I'll be accused. But you know what? Who cares? I think people are a little bit, I think well-intentioned people might be a little bit, wary of either owning mistakes because of what they think the consequences might be, or sticking their head or, you know, holding up their hand and going, can we talk about this or whatever? So I'm hoping that by doing this, I'm trying to sort of say this is something that we can do, and hopefully more people will do. I actually, I'm going to dig somebody out here, somebody in the whole world who will never know me and I'll never know him. But I just feel like it's such a shame. This is a bit of an abstract one here, but when Colin Kaepernick got down on one knee that first time, and that was a while ago now, this is way before Black Lives Matter. And then he was, Colin Kaepernick still doesn't play in the NFL. I mean, by the way, that's unbelievable. But I had this daydream fantasy of how great it would have been. Can you imagine if after it was like, if you kneel down at the national anthem, you'll be thrown out of the stadium and all this. And I think it was Trump that said it all. Can you imagine how extraordinary the world would have been, even just for a few days, if Tom Brady had got on one knee in the next national anthem?
Yeah.
Can you imagine how big that would have been? Because Tom Brady's bulletproof. He couldn't have been fired. No one's going to fire Tom Brady. No one's. And I was like, dude, you could have in one movement, you could have made such a difference. And, I think if we feel that moment, I think if you're an ally, you want to be an ally and you feel that moment, then you've got to try and seize it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
I think the sad thing is that it's his choice, but like he was a Trump supporter. He believed in many of the ideas and the miscommunications around what Colin was doing. And I think, racism could be
solved. Never going to happen.
Yeah, racism could be solved very, very quickly. It's not actually a very complex scenario, and it just requires people to be present to the things that they're saying, doing, and why things are the way they are. But also, it's just like it's so centered in how people feel about themselves, and almost like we're better. The idea that you could be white working class and I actually could earn more money than you, but somehow you still feel pride of being white British and how having Anglo-Saxon is like the premier experience. But you could have literally, you could be hand to mouthing it every single month. And I feel like that divide that has been created, is so illogical and so unworkable. And we probably have way more in common. I grew up on a estate in East London, and it was very white working class on the estate. I think I was one of three families that were of color, on the estate. And we had so much in common on a human level, but there was almost this like superiority of, but we're white. And, if I ever got my moment in the sun, I could assimilate to, how whiteness works easier than anybody else could. And I'm just waiting for my moment. And, some people felt I just didn't need to because they felt superior. We won the war. We won the 1966 World Cup. This is what the pride was. We used to dominate these countries. Yeah,
why is this country so obsessed with the war? It's so weird.
And look, they actually believe they ended fascism on their own. It's just like there's lots of narratives. The US think they won the war on their own. The English think they won the war on their own. Depending on who you speak to, it all happened because of their decision to end these things. And they completely ignore the challenges and the pain that they cause as Britain going around the world and colonizing pretty much every black and brown country, or at least somewhere on every single continent.
It's not taught in school. If it was taught in schools, it'd be a whole different ballgame, I'm sure. Here's the thing where me and my missus, who's American, I'm over in Florida with her now. And we went to Ireland about 2 years ago, something like that. And we drove, across Ireland, Dublin, across Ireland, down the west coast of Ireland. And we did a few tours and whatever. And what was fascinating to me is that they talked about Oliver Cromwell. And it only occurred to me literally 2 years ago that in my history, my GCSE history back then, Oliver Cromwell was talked about not as a hero because it was more of a kind of a neutral, history was more neutral. It's certainly about the Civil War because, Charles I, Oliver Cromwell, it's like there's no clear, good guy, bad guy, there is in, the war. But he was sort of, described as a sort of well-meaning patriot. Go to Ireland, they don't think that at all. He was appalling, just murdered hundreds of thousands of them, never taught in English history classes. And I just think that could make a massive difference if we sort of had some sense of ownership of what having an empire meant and what we did and what our history is, because we genuinely, I say we, I growing up as a, when I was a young white British lad, I thought we were a decent bunch. Like I was like, historically, we won the war and we're the good guys, right? And I don't think it's psychologically damaging to generations to learn the truth about what happened in the past. I don't think that's, you look at Germany and they've got incredibly progressive liberal society. I don't think it's a terribly bad thing.
And I think absolutely in many ways, because you're right. You've seen how countries have rebranded. Belgium's another one. If you think about Leopold and what he did in Congo, he actually killed more people than Hitler did. And so, how they've rebranded themselves, they've actually ignored large parts. But when George Floyd was happening, people were tearing down some of the posters of their previous leaders, their statues of previous leaders, because it was incredibly problematic to celebrate those people and after what they had done. And this connection to people historically who did things that nobody in the present state would do is because the true power, and again, the UK is trying to be a mini US in terms of the level of patriotic sentiment that they're pushing into us. And it just doesn't fly because it hasn't won. It has never really landed. Like even the British flag compared to the English flag has different connotations. And when you see them, what they were used for, the tools that they were used for so long, But if you, there's no way that you can continue using the flag in a way that Conservative Party, every time they speak on TV, they have a flag behind them. It triggers a whole bunch of people because you've never repaired with those people what the flag has mean before you try to make it up and hold it out as the symbol. And that's a really important part of it, is the repair process has to happen in terms of this on a social level, but also on a structural level. It has to happen on both levels before people can move on. And I 2 weeks ago, we spoke to David Lammy about the vision for Britain, and we couldn't land on anything. It was the most frustrating conversation. I felt like we had the brains to do it. We had the desire to do it, but nobody could identify what is Britain trying to be right now. And we're in this kind of stuck place of, you know, being almost like a failed state. We're behaving like a failed state. We have a great opportunity in terms of what Britain stands for and what Britain can create to actually unite a lot of people. And it all starts in language, all of it. It starts in language. It starts with how we talk about each other.
But we're stuck because everybody's looking backwards. Challenges. Everyone's obsessed with British exceptionalism. Everyone's obsessed with won the war, we had an empire. It's like people who weren't part of any of those things have this weird fantasy idea of what it is. And they look back and hark back and go, we need to be great. It doesn't mean anything. It's very difficult to plan for the future when you're always looking back over your shoulder. America and Britain, if I'm honest, both have this, suffer from their own exceptionalism.
I think where the challenge lies is that if you think about, even for the Black community and even the South Asian community, I think 46% of all Black people are in London. So there's a socioeconomic South London, North and South divide. And so imagine if you empower a whole generation, you're basically, the benefits of that will be Black and brown people, is because ultimately the North-South divide, but then a class issue needs to be addressed. Why the North of England isn't getting the investment? Why we haven't found, you know, industry, or we haven't found a vision for the North of England and how we regenerate it? Because then, you start looking at the Conservative Party and you're like, well, you've been in power for 15 years. What have you done for the North of England? If you don't feel good about your experience, so it's really important. The divide is not necessarily about race. Race is just a tool that continues to divide. This is my opinion. And so if you actually remove race, then if you're in a small town in England, yes, you feel like your life isn't great, but you can still look and be like, there's them. You have a person in your mind, you vision there's a culture war, and there's no culture war. I've never even experienced any idea of a culture war or, them and us. And it's just us. It's us, people who do have and people who don't have, people
just
who
just on Twitter.
Yeah, it's just an absolute
just
nonsense
on Twitter
ecosystem.
And LBC call-ins.
Yeah, and they do very well from it.
It's one more point about. I like the idea. I've reframed this. It's like, help me, I'm white.
It's really hard for you.
There's a. I know. You don't listen. Walk a man in my shoes, man. When's it going to be our time?
now.
Yeah, it's been my time for thousands of years, hundreds certainly. I've got two mixed race friends. By the way, I don't know if my terminology is because I try to keep up with terminology, but if I've said anything offensive, then please do excuse me and do feel free to correct me. I've got no, I won't be offended if you go, you're not supposed to say mixed race, but unless you do, I'll continue.
Dual heritage, it depends. Dual heritage is probably better.
Okay, so I have two dual heritage friends, and both of them, different backgrounds. One I used to play football with, one's my best friend now. And both of them have adopted an attitude in life, which is that they almost are like, oh, sort of almost not Thatcherism, because they're not Thatcherites, right? But this idea of going, take your own personal responsibility and don't complain about institutional racism and you'll succeed if whatever. Now, my take on that is, well, look, that might work for you, but if there's a system that's horribly unbalanced, then it still needs to be corrected. I'm asking you what your thoughts are on that, because I know that it makes white people who are feeling uncomfortable that they're part of a system that creates disparity of power, of power and societal imbalance and oppression. It makes them feel better to hear dual heritage friends or Black friends talk in that way. And I guess I'm sort of saying it shouldn't. That's not the answer.
I think it's really interesting because. What actually happens is, so the ideology of capitalism creates this anyway. And then underpinning that is masculinity. And so when you put those two things together, it's almost like masculinity is a way of defending yourself against any idea of weakness. And masculinity can live in women as well. It's not just universally a man thing. And so, you know, this idea about what impacts you and what shapes your narrative. Some people just refuse to have any narrative attributed to them. And they have the mental capacity, the privilege, the disconnection to their emotions to really just drive through this idea that nothing impacts me. You can't make me a victimized Black person. I am a success because of it. And it always comes down to this proximity to power in terms of what you've experienced or how disconnected you are to your actual feelings. You know, the things that we talk about microaggressions, and it's not really even microaggressions, it's just aggressions. But these things, that tiny things that happen to you and build up over a period of time, if you're in tune, if you're an empath and you feel, and someone talks about your hair, the way you speak, the way you walk, the way you dress, you're a Mandingo, you know, these little comments that happen that are relatively well-meaning, or they might be misconstrued, or they could be just malicious. But, you know, these things happen all the time. What comes out of an empath is that I've had enough. And they can see a limit to one in these interactions. These start to impact how you feel, very similar to how you talked about being on the football field. And I think when we talk about then the other person is the person who creates that culture. And then, again, the people, if you even ask the question about the men who created the culture that you walked into, who are they? Where did they come from? What was their story? And you start to really dig into this idea that there will be people in the Black community who do not believe that they're a victim of anything, because they figured out a way to survive this environment. And so then they think, actually, they become a proponent of it. They become somebody who perpetuates the environment because they think, well, you're not a man if you can't survive this, because I survived it and I'm a man. And what we're saying is that actually not everyone is built like that. And we actually don't want everyone to be built like that. We want people to be who they are and be able to survive the environments that we put them in. This idea about capitalism, meritocracy, you know, survivors of the fittest is a very unhealthy idea. It's been hyper masculine. It's been hyper capitalized. It's been to a point that it comes at the destruction of so many people. And so when we're talking about how we want to live, I want to be able to either tune into the nth degree of capitalism, become a billionaire, but I also want to be able to not do that. And I want to become a nurse. And I want to care for people. And I don't want to be destroyed by the person who is at the top of capitalism in terms of what I want to be. And I think that's where we are today. You know, the NHS is being run to the ground, and, you know, and we clap for them all year and they got 1% pay increase. That for me doesn't even make sense. And so this is where, you know, I don't want to discredit someone, you know, dual heritage person who's had their own lived experience. They have a reason for who they are. But I think sometimes you can have your view as long as you're not using it as a tool to weaponize against people who aren't as fortunate as you.
Well, that's what I thought, to be honest. I was like, well, like I said, if that's what armor you've built to thrive and survive in this world, then I respect that. But equally, I don't want to see potential white allies using that as an excuse going, well, he said it's okay. It's like, no, it that don't work. I have one last question for you. One very quick question, because, yeah. Is it getting better? Even incrementally, do you think? And if not,
contextualize better.
I don't know. I mean, I suppose you were talking about that with David Lammy. Like, do you feel optimistic that there's a way forward?
I feel optimistic in the sense that as a community, specifically in a racial conversation. Again, I'll say this for gender as an observer of it, is that the collectivizing of people to come together on the issues that impact them has happened more now than ever. But I think the discourse has got more toxic. And I think it's become almost performatively so. I think about Piers Morgan, and I think I guarantee you, you know, Alex Beresford has spoken a few times and said that he's a great guy. And he's on one realm, he's helped him in his career, he's given him tips about his broadcasting, he's brought him onto the platform to have a voice on some of these conversations. But I think, like, we've got to a place now when people aren't even considering that we each other are human beings. We're platforming and clickbaiting. But what we're actually doing is creating a condition for the extremities of all of those views to now have a home. And we've now platformed, you know, GB News is destined to be the most ridiculous platform of all time.
I know.
Following what, you know, Fox News is. Just, it's just there just to say the opposite of what decent humanity is. And I feel like it's like, you know, even the conversation around things like freedom of speech, these are just like, you know, freedom of speech was really about pursuing the ability to hold people in power to account. It wasn't about people in power to say whatever they want and punch back. It's always the ability to have the everyday person being able to say something about billionaires or people in power or even a neighbor. And it'd be okay. And
there's a lot of people out there who don't quite know what freedom of speech
means. It's a brilliant, you know, decoy.
They think it basically means I need to be able to say what I want. Yeah.
It's horrific. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, it's getting better because the minimum level of expectation that people are prepared to accept is lower than ever. But now we've just had more people, and these people have a lot of money, they have a lot of resources, they have a lot of time, and they seem to be on our screens and in positions of decision making. Are digging in their heels, holding on to something that actually doesn't help their life. Like, if you even think to somebody who speaks so ill of any community group, and you think to yourself, then you don't have that person in your life. Like, the idea that I have white people in my life, I have gay people in my life, I have women in my life, I wouldn't remove a portion of them to just like, to be right about something that I think I'm right about. Like, no, I want you in my life. I want to experience the richness of different people and cultures in my life because that's the best lived experience. Like, I want to discover things of you. I want to eat your food made by you. I want to, you know, hear your stories about what happened to you growing up. That's just a normal human being, and that should be just heavily normalized. We always talk about it as if like helping, you know, black people is about taking something from somewhere else, or, you know, helping the lived experience of gay people is like saying that being heterosexual is wrong. Like, none of this is, it's not an or, it's an and. And I feel like we've got to a bit of a dark place where that discourse has been platformed very, very heavily. And they've had allowed to have that conversation uncontested. And now they've got their own network, and it will continue to get more and more ridiculous. But I just think, you know, Britain has put itself in a position where it isn't a superpower anymore by choice, by the way. This isn't like, you know, people, it just isn't by choice. It's no longer a superpower, and it's moving itself into isolation every single year. And people will just move into another place in 20 years' time. It'll be like, I want to live in China, and the same thing will happen there in terms of what's happening here. Like, the world will evolve without Britain at the center of it, and it will never be able to colonize the world like it once did in a million years, because the superpowers have completely shifted.
Agreed. I think it's a, I hate to say it, but I think it's a, I think it's going to wane into global sort of insignificance now. By choice, exactly like you say. And look, this week, Alex Barrett, I don't know if it was this week, but in the last few weeks, Thierry Henry signed off Twitter. He said, I'm not doing Twitter anymore because of racist abuse. And Alex Beresford didn't make an announcement. He just left. It's got to change. Listen, thanks, man. I appreciate your time.
No worries, man. We'll definitely do this again. It'd be great to do this on your platform and continue the conversation, because I'm sure there'll be some sort of follow-up from this, and there'll be some afterthoughts that you have. We can continue them in the next conversation. And I think, you know, I appreciate you sticking your hand up. Thanks for coming on and being really open, and also being really open about the thing with the Michael Jackson cast. And I think not everybody owns their own thing. So I think standing in your own, you know, mistakes and errors is a really powerful thing. And so, you know, thank you for doing that. We can all learn significantly amount from that experience.
Nice one, man. Absolute pleasure. Speak to you soon.
Absolutely. Thank you. And so thank you guys for listening. I really much appreciate it. We'll be back next week with another episode. You can find us at Dope Black Dads on all social media platforms. You can also email me for a chat at hello@dopeblackdads.com. Thank you so much for listening, my brothers. I appreciate you all. We'll be back next week.
An unforgettable day out at Kildare Village isn't just about discovering what's new in your favourite boutiques. It's not just about complimentary parking and fresh air, fresh fashion, or about unmissable restaurants and pop-ups and shopping under clear blue skies. And it's not just about spectacular savings all year round. No, an unforgettable day out in Kildare Village is about all this in one beautiful open-air setting. Kildare Village. Something extraordinary every day.
Orla's driving her new Citroën C4 crossover. She's on a call with her friend who's asking if her in-laws from hell have left yet. Orla's husband is in the front seat. The in-laws are in the back seat. Orla is on hands-free. This could be a very uncomfortable drive. Except the Citroën C4 crossover comes with advanced comfort seats and best-in-class rear legroom. making it a very comfortable drive indeed. Citroën, engineered for comfort. See citroen.ie.